Managing Violence Podcast, Season 5, Episode 8, Gershon Ben-Keren. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Managing Violence Podcast. I hope you're keeping well. I hope you're keeping safe. I am joined today by our first ever three-time guest on the Managing Violence Podcast, Mr. Gershon Ben-Keren. He is most well known as Krav Maga author and instructor extraordinaire, based in Boston, originally from Glasgow. But we're talking to him today from a clinical background because he also holds a bachelor's degree as well as soon to be two master's degrees in psychology and criminology. And we're talking to him today about psychopathy and sociopathy and why it's important to understand what we're talking about when we throw those terms around, especially when we're talking about a violence prevention or self-defense context. But before we get into the interview with Gershon, I just need to thank our newest contributor to the Managing Violence Patreon tribe, Mr. Lee Barrett. Lee has joined the tribal council and will now be receiving a whole bunch of perks. So welcome to the team, Lee. We greatly appreciate your support. Now, a little announcement from me as well. I've got to give you a peek behind the curtain a little bit at the moment. I, up until very recently, had considered making this the final season of the Managing Violence Podcast. I was starting to wonder if I had contributed about as much as I could. I talked to nearly everybody I wanted to. There's still a handful of people out there that I haven't reached out to or I haven't been able to secure yet. But I thought we'd done a good job. We'd kicked the hornet's nest a little bit within the self-defense community, and I felt like we'd come close to realizing the mission, which was to start having some more intelligent conversations about self-defense and violence management. And I had considered whether maybe we would wind up after season five, or at least take an indefinite hiatus to allow me to focus on other projects. Because as I've mentioned previously, there is another project I have bubbling away, another podcast that I'd like to put a little bit more time into as I get that started. I also have a handful of half-written books which probably need to be finished so they see the light of day. So I'm not just one of those guys that has a ton of half-written books that no one's ever read. So I did consider whether Managing Violence had run its course and needed to take a break. But as I've reflected upon that decision over the last couple of weeks, and I'm seeing what's happening in the US, in other countries, I just think that now is not that time. I feel like what we're doing is so important now, as people are feeling less safe in their communities, they're feeling less safe when they're out and about. People from all walks of life, I'm not talking about any one demographic, people in general I think are feeling less safe at the moment, and I think we have a duty to continue providing information that helps people feel safer and helps people be more informed about how to manage conflict and troubling social situations. So we will be back for season six. So we've got a couple more episodes of season five. I will be coming back for season six. I just wanted to share that with you guys because I came very, very close to pulling the plug, but I think what we're doing is too important to leave it here. So with your support, we will be back for season six. Please continue to support the show. As long as people are listening and I'm getting feedback that people are enjoying it and they're benefiting from the show, then we will continue on. So now that that's off my chest, without further ado, here is Mr. Gershon Ben-Keren. I'm joined here by Gershon Ben-Keren, the first ever three-time guest on the Managing Violence Podcast. Yeah, there's been a couple of two-timers, but you're the first one who's come back for three times. So welcome back.
You can't get rid of me.
Right, anytime I get to interview a Jewish Scot living in the US, I'll take the opportunity. How's things for you, man?
It's good. Obviously, it's like kind of a strange time. We're in lockdown here. So I haven't been teaching live in-person classes for around 2 months. We're hoping that's going to change with an announcement by the mayor on Friday. I was in conversation with their office earlier this week, and they were sort of saying, wait to Friday. Because martial arts falls into a funny category that we're kind of not personal training. We're not a gym, we're something else. So we think that we've got a good setup here. We're in a big space at 16,000 square foot. So what we've done is actually hung double end bags at 20 feet intervals. And we have like 10 sets. So we're looking to kind of go, okay, you come in, that's your station. So you're located there. You work the bag, we do drills, blah, 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 blah. We can maintain that social distancing. It's also been interesting because we've got this kind of, with the Black Lives Matter, a lot of protests going on, some of which has turned into rioting and looting, and there's a lot of talk about civil unrest, which was interesting that when this whole period started, I actually did a presentation on civil unrest, more from the basis of would the pandemic and the response to the pandemic lead to civil unrest. And now we've seen kind of another reason why we could be entering such a period. I think civil unrest is often an overused term, but when we talk about kind of the history and the idea of the mob and mob mentality and all that type of things and the different sort of psychological factors at play, it's a good discussion point.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly it could be another show in itself, probably a series of shows. So the reason that that you're back on for this particular episode, we've spoken about your Krav Maga background, we've spoken about some of your work in workplace violence, but what I actually wanted to draw upon in this episode is your clinical training and your background in psychology. So for those that haven't listened to the first couple of episodes, can you just run through a little bit of your academic pedigree to lay a foundation for what we're going to talk about?
Okay, so I did my original bachelor's degree in psychology. I did my master's in psychology and forensic psychology, which is kind of where this part of talking about psychopathy really comes in. I've worked alongside people in forensic settings where psychopathy has been one of those personality disorders when you're working with a prison population and with offenders. We find a disproportionate number of people with antisocial personality disorder and psychopathy, and the two are separate, and hopefully we'll kind of get to that in this discussion. So I've had that forensic setting. I've also, in terms of workplace violence, and I think this is sort of a key disclaimer to point out, I am not qualified as an individual to make a diagnosis of psychopathy. Often when I get called in terms of threat management and mitigation, where an ex-employee or a current employee has said something, the company want to know, is this person a psychopath? Do they have a personality disorder? And my kind of point is, it's very difficult outside of a clinical setting to basically diagnose somebody. So one of the things we'll look at, again, hopefully that will come out in the discussion, is about how psychopathy itself is kind of measured on a scale. So although there are cutoff points where you'd say, yes, in a clinical setting, this person would constitute and be diagnosed as a psychopath, we can turn around and say, well, look, you know, on the scale, the average person may have a score of five. The person we're looking at seems to be heading towards the other end of that scale. So although we can't make a diagnosis that this person is a psychopath, we can say they have psychopathic tendencies, and that might be able to help guide us in ascertaining the level of threat and how we handle it.
Yeah, so there's so many topics there to unpack, and I think it's probably prudent to explain to listeners how this conversation came about, because you and I have been going back and forth on this for a little while, and I've tagged you in a few posts to drag you into conversation you might have otherwise seen. And it's sort of been a bit of a bugbear of mine. As you know, I also did my undergrad in psychology, and I see self-defense instructors, it's always been this way, but we always talk about the psychopaths or the sociopaths or the, and there's like this almost romanticized image of the psychopath being, you know, the knife man in the shower, you know, like it's going to be the serial killer. It's the Criminal Minds episode. It's like, and then when you have that idea of what a psychopath is, and then you read statistics about one in however many people are psychopaths, it suddenly becomes very scary. So it's what the reason I wanted to have this conversation was really just to clear up some of those myths and get your perspective, having not just being clinically trained, but also a self-defense instructor, a Krav Maga instructor, and also having extensive experience in the security and protection field as well. I think you're fairly uniquely qualified to offer a rounded discussion about this rather than just being purely clinical or purely martial arts focused. So let's just start there. What do you think are some of the biggest misconceptions? And even just when we're planning this, we already outlined one of the misconceptions, which was we lump sociopathy and psychopathy and antisocial personality disorder into almost like the one basket when they're three different things.
I guess I think one of the biggest myths is that of violence, that, movies like, I think there's been a Silence of the Lambs phenomena where I noticed this. So I was doing undergrad at the time of Silence of the Lambs, and psychopathy was kind of like, it's an interesting field, but it's fairly young. We're really only just kind of getting to grips with it. If I remember correctly, I think Robert Hare, just when I started university, came out with the psychopathy checklist, which has since been revised. So really, we were only at that point getting to a grip to actually agree on what a psychopath kind of could be defined as and how we would go about making the diagnosis. Silence of the Lambs came out at roughly the same time. So if you look at it that way, Silence of the Lambs wasn't really creating a psychopath on any scientific basis. It was very anecdotal, and I'm not saying it didn't do a good job in certain regards. And I noticed very soon after that, you started getting sort of things like going, it's 1%. So that's 1 in 100 people that you are going to meet are psychopaths. And so suddenly now it became this much more like 1 in 100. Well, if I join a company where there's 100 people, one of those people are going to be a psychopath, and now the term workplace psychopath started to get bandied around, and the media and certain academics, unfortunately, started sort of making out that this was a much more prevalent condition. And also that every time that you were going to meet it, you were going to meet this person as a serial killer. And again, I think this is one of the important things to note. And again, I think when we start talking about what people mean by sociopath and what they mean by psychopath, we'll see that really psychopathy isn't a categorical measurement. It's on a scale. So you have people who we refer to as successful psychopaths. So people who score highly, but are able to integrate into society and become productive members of society. And they are unlikely to be violent because they understand the consequences of that, even if they might be emotionally motivated to do that. But I think the biggest misconception, and when I talk about psychopathy and I have diagnosed psychopaths kind of respond to me, their biggest complaint is we're not all violent offenders. So they kind of don't want to be judged in this way. And I think it's interesting to know, we were talking a bit earlier, kind of off script, about how the very term psychopath has emotional luggage attached to it. It's a personality disorder. It's a condition. It's something we diagnose. And working in the field of psychology, I look on it in terms of a disorder in the same way that maybe a sports injury doctor would look at flat feet. It's a diagnosis. You've got flat feet. It's not a judgment, of like, oh God, you've got flat feet. But psychopathy tends to get labeled with that emotion. And the problem with that is we can end up misunderstanding both the person we're misdiagnosing as being a psychopath and also the condition itself.
It seems that in colloquial speak that psychopath is a synonym for evil, and that's just patently untrue. But As you said, it's got such emotional luggage that the only time we talk about psychopaths is in the wake of some horrifically violent crime, or incredibly toxic work behavior, for example. Yeah, this is really the only time the term comes up. So I think probably just as a foundation for the conversation, let's define terms a little bit. So what is psychopathy?
So I would start a little bit earlier than that and go, psychopathy is a personality disorder. So what we first have to understand is, like, what's a personality disorder and what's a mental illness? So really, if we look at what a personality disorder is, it's a condition in which a person thinks, feels, perceives, relates to others in a way that is different to the majority of people. The easiest way is maybe to look on it as we have something called the personality functioning continuum, where we have healthy adaptive people at this end and, put hands in screen so you can see, unhealthy maladaptive people at this end. And most of us exist somewhere along this spectrum. And most of our maladaptive behaviors don't really cause us any problems. So we might have a shortness of temper, but really we can rein that in. We can control it. So when we're looking at personality disorders, these are things which are problematic and persistent. So it's not something that a person can just choose not to do. It's kind of their worldview, how they think of things. And that worldview and how they think of things is very different to the rest of us. So this makes something like psychopathy different to a mental illness such as schizophrenia. So, you know, schizophrenia is an illness. It's so, you know, with the psychosis and the way that people are seeing the world in a kind of fantastical way. So somebody with a psychosis might view you as suddenly being this fire-breathing dragon. Somebody with a personality disorder isn't going to do that. They can interact with you and deal with you, but their angle that they look at you is slightly different. So for instance, if we take paranoid personality disorder, I know it's stereotypical to think about that person as always thinking about somebody's out to get them. It's actually more complicated than that, involves rigid black and white type thinking. But the paranoid person is going to think when they interact with you that you're trying to get one over on them, that you're trying to con them, you're trying to do, that's their view of the world. They're not seeing you as a fire-breathing dragon. They're still seeing you as an individual, but motivated in another way. So the kind of way to think about the disorders, and the DSM sort of identifies 10, psychopathy isn't included. It's kind of a subset within antisocial personality disorder. To think about it, you're dealing with people who are seeing the world kind of as you do, but in a slightly different angle and from a slightly different perspective, in a way that is going to cause them problems in terms of interacting with everybody. So psychopathy is a personality disorder. So I think that's always the first thing, you know, to define. And it's interesting that when it was first kind of mentioned, defined by Philippe Pinel, he sort of said it was an illness of affection, of emotion, not reason. That these individuals are capable of reasoning and functioning as a normal person, but there's kind of a problem with their emotional disposition and the way that they interpret and respond emotionally.
Yeah, and I think that's everything you say is worthy of exploration, but I think one of the things just to draw out there, because it's again from my experience, a misconception that I see a lot is and I think it's just a matter of lack of knowledge, is people correlate psychopathy with psychosis. It's like, oh, he's psychotic. It's like, well, no. Being psychotic is completely different.
Totally different.
Yeah, they sound the same, but they're not the same thing.
Yes, and this was a thing where Harvey M. Cleckley, who wrote The Mask of Sanity, I think 1941, which was one of the first times when an actual sort of clinical population were kind of investigated from this sort of view of psychopathy. And, you know, his whole thing was, these people aren't mad. You know, it's they're not mad people. And that's, again, what Pinnell was trying to sort of say, that before we've looked on disorders as people being mad, these people aren't mad. They're able to reason. But there's something emotionally different about them that makes them interact with others differently. So it's kind of like, you know, the mask of sanity, as Cleckley put it. You know, it all looks absolutely sane. And the way they're moving around the world kind of looks sane, until you really get under the covers, or really start investigating their relationships with others. But on the mask of things, these people look to be functioning as normally as anybody else.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that the vast majority of people that are psychopaths, and again, that term just seems so loaded, even just when I say it in this context, but that they are perfectly well-functioning individuals. They keep things under control.
Well, you have kind of two types, and we refer to these, and they're not kind of official terms. They've kind of like sort of organically grown out of research, where we talk about the successful psychopath who learns how to behave and understand the world. So when you talk to psychopaths about, hang on a minute, there's kind of an emotional disconnect here. They'll tell you that, yeah, I don't, when I'm looking at you, I don't get the emotional feedback, but I can cognitively understand your mood and how you're thinking. So whilst a psychopath wouldn't be able to emotionally empathize or understand that you were feeling sad or that you were feeling hurt, they would be able to cognitively interpret your emotional state and kind of stick a label on it and go, that person is sad, this is what sad means. For me to be successful, I am going to have to respond to them in this way. So it's like following a script. There's a famous quote, I forget who made it, who said, you know, they're hearing the words, but not the music, you know, which I think it really sums it up quite well. So the successful psychopath knows possibly when they've offended you, and they know, okay, this is what I do to kind of rectify this, because I know if I've offended you, that my end goal isn't going to get met. The unsuccessful psychopath is the guy who's like running around like a loose cannon, who can't read signals and signs. And then only the guys that get arrested and put in prison. So there's an issue as well when we look at populations of psychopaths who we study, that we could be looking in the prison population at the unsuccessful psychopaths, and because that's where most of the research is, actually missing out how do the successful psychopaths function. So how does the CEO, who actually, if he was to sit down and be diagnosed, you know, and comes up on that cutter point where we go, yes, he's diagnosed as a psychopath, how is he managing to cope with this disorder? How has he managed to kind of hide certain parts of it or use certain parts of it to enjoy success? So I think there's also a danger in terms of the populations that we research and investigate, if that makes sense, where we could actually be being misled, as it were.
Yeah, I think it might have even been Rory Miller in the first season that said something on the lines of most of our psychology research tells us a lot about first-year psych students.
Yes.
Because they're the ones that volunteer to be studied. So
yeah, it's funny. I've just finished a thesis for my second master's, which is in criminology and criminal psychology. And, you know, there's a gap of around 20 years, actually probably closer to 30. And the big bit I struggled with in the thesis was really remembering how important the methodology was and explaining that methodology, why you've chosen to do it this way, not another way. And I think that's kind of one of the things where so much research has been done on the prison population. And there's good reason to, when we look at the disproportionate number of people suffering from psychopathy in the prison population and the amount of money that they cost the economy in terms of their offending, it's kind of right that we focus on that. But at the same time, we might not be fully understanding the condition because we're understanding that unsuccessful subsection of the group.
Yeah. Another term that gets thrown around in the same conversation is sociopathy. Do you just want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So let me kind of give a quick rundown of the history of psychopathy and where sociopathy fits in, why the term was created, and how it's come into sort of common parlance. And I know there are people who are going to kind of go, that's not what I mean by sociopath. And I understand that. So I'm not necessarily criticizing people's use of the term. However, coming from that academic background, I think terminology is key. And we can't define something by what it's not. And this really, to me, is the crux of the sociopath term. So, like I said, Pinel kind of was the first to mention this condition, which he called insanity without delirium. Like, these are mad people, but they appear kind of sane. Cleckley picked up on this. Robert Hare, I think it was 1991, came up with the first checklist, which was revised in 2003. And really, we need to start with Hare and go, this was the first time where somebody actually gave us a way of defining and diagnosing psychopathy. So this is really, really important, because before that, psychopathy meant different things to different people. So this was something that everybody kind of got on board with and went, okay, we have a common definition of psychopathy. So when we're talking about psychopaths in the US, we can use the same language as psychopaths in the UK, blah, blah, blah. So we have this scientific method. And I can talk more about the checklist later, but it's not so important at the moment. The problem was that a guy in 1909, Carl Binbaum, introduced the term sociopath. And what he was trying to do was, at the time, psychopathy wasn't defined well. So this is where we have to go back and go, Hare came up with this kind of definition. But before that, it meant a lot of different sort of types of antisocial misbehaving. And Binbaum actually, if I remember correctly, identified 20 different subtypes. So he was saying, like, this broad term psychopathy, which was being used to kind of really just describe a variety of antisocial behaviors, actually has distinct subtypes. So there was a guy, a prominent psychologist in the US, Georgie Partridge, who in the 30s took that term. And what Binbaum was trying to say, which was actually quite revolutionary at the time, was there might be social reasons rather than biological reasons for people to be acting in this way. And what was quite revolutionary was, at the time, the majority of criminologists were coming from, and psychologists and psychiatrists, from a much more positivist stance, saying, like, it's biological reasoning. So Binbaum was quite revolutionary at the time. But he was trying to say there were social causes possibly behind this antisocial behavior. Partridge picked this up and sort of popularized it in the 30s. So then when the American Psychiatric Association came up with the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, they didn't pick up on psychopathy because it hadn't really been defined at the moment. So they sort of said, well, there's antisocial personality disorder. And so what happened was you had psychopathy being included sort of in antisocial personality disorder. There never has been a really defined definition of what sociopathy is. And so it's come to mean almost, if you've got antisocial personality disorder and this subset of psychopaths within it, everybody else is a sociopath. The problem with that is you're not defining what sociopath actually is. You're saying there are people who behave in an antisocial manner who are not psychopaths. And again, you know, we're going obviously through a big discussion at race at the moment, in this time in history. It would be me saying, well, there's the world population, then there's Caucasian people, and everybody else is a non-Caucasian person. And we know that would be a really stupid way of kind of defining things. And really what the danger is that we start saying that these people who don't fall into the definition of psychopathy are all the same, when it's more likely that they fall in to other subgroups within that antisocial personality disorder. The problem then you had was people wanted to join the landscapes. So you had people wanting to kind of make sense of the definition of antisocial personality disorder and sort of join it up with psychopathy. So psychopathy is, in Robert Hare's checklist, is divided into two groups. There's factor one, which is interpersonal and affective, and the factor two, which is lifestyle and antisocial. So people look at what's on the factor two list, the lifestyle and antisocial, and go, well, actually, that marries up to a certain extent with the definition of antisocial personality disorder. So you've had people who've said there's two types of psychopathy. There's type one, which is kind of all of it. And then you have these type two people who behave in an antisocial manner. So let's call those type two people sociopaths, the people who fit them all psychopaths. And now we've kind of like made sense of the language. Where really, to my mind, what we should be saying is there isn't a diagnosis for sociopaths. The only way we can diagnose it on the current nomenclature is to say what it's not. It's people suffering antisocial personality disorders who don't fit the definition of psychopath. The issue, I think, with that, it's an unscientific way of defining. You know, we should be defining things because, again, in psychology and psychiatry, we talk about pertinent negatives. So a pertinent negative is something that when we make a diagnosis is missing. So we might turn around and say that somebody who we're going to class as a narcissist has to have five characteristics out of a list of eight, for example. If one of those characteristics is missing, they only have four, then we have to turn around and say there's a pertinent negative. There's something missing that doesn't enable us to make that diagnosis. Because we don't have such a list defining sociopathy, how can we make a diagnosis that somebody is a sociopath? And a lot of the problems have come because Robert Hare intended the psychopathy checklist to be a scale. So basically, there's 40 kind of questions, as it were. You get 20 questions, and the score is 40. You get a zero if one isn't present. If it's sometimes present, you get a one. If it's strongly present, you get a two. So there's 20 of these things, maximum score of 40. And it's a scale, so people are on this. What people trying to use the term sociopathy have done have turned the scale into a categorical measure that people are either in this category, they're in factor one, or they're in this category, which is factor two. So they're using the checklist in a way that it wasn't meant to be used. Now, Hare has argued that the psychopathy checklist, the definition of psychopathy, should be identified in the DSM as a distinct disorder to antisocial personality disorder. The problem with that is, and this is again understanding the point of the manual, is to diagnose a condition. And so you have things in Hare's checklist where he'll talk about, does the individual have glib superficial charm? How do you measure glib superficial charm? It's difficult. Whereas if you look on the antisocial personality disorder, it'll have something along the lines of somebody who repeatedly performs acts that are grounds for arrest. Yeah. So has the person been arrested? I can measure that.
Yeah.
So the DSM and the psychopathy checklist are kind of measuring different things. And this again can be a problem with the DSM when it gets used in a legal setting. because it wasn't intended to be used in a legal setting. It was intended to diagnose a condition in order to treat it. And this is, again, where sometimes, you know, in court proceedings, we've had a psychiatrist report on the individual and he's been diagnosed as a psychopath. And suddenly now a whole load of behaviors get associated with that diagnosis. So this person can be unfairly treated within a legal setting because a jury is hearing, like you said, psychopath, the guy must be evil. And that wasn't what the DSM was intended to do. So I think a lot of the confusions and problems around sociopathy and psychopathy and antisocial personality disorder comes from us trying to say that they can all make sense together and they're all measuring different facets of the same thing, where really they're tools for measuring very different things for very different reasons. I hope that makes sense, because it's one of those conversations every time I have it, I realize that like I'm kind of going around in circles, filling a bit in here, missing a bit out there, you know, there's historical context and all this business. I think in short, my line is, it's better to turn around and say, there's this broad umbrella term, antisocial personality disorder, which contains a group that we're able to identify and diagnose as psychopaths who exist on a scale, and kind of leave it at that. That's what we can do. We can do safely. I think there is a danger to sort of coming up with a condition to which there is no way of measuring it. And that's the problem with sociopathy.
Yeah. And I think it's what you provide there is really valuable, especially for those of us that are instructors that might be using these terms without really understanding them or based upon, you know, pop science books or whatever, wherever we've come across this material. Sociopath and narcissist and like, we need to understand what these mean or if they mean anything. And if they don't mean anything, if it's just your interpretation of the term or how you're using it, that's fine. Just make sure that you're explaining that's what it is. It's not an actual condition. You know?
And there's also an issue with a lot of these disorders where there's comorbidity, where we had a thing in the UK where it wasn't a clinical term. And basically everybody within the forensic and clinical setting went, hang on a minute, you can't do that. Where the government defined the term, which was dangerous and severe personality disorder, which was basically when people suffering from psychopathy had a comorbid condition of borderline personality disorder. And it was found that these people were statistically higher of committing violent offenses. And there's a couple of issues here with comorbidity. Is you have an axis one condition and an axis two, so a primary condition and a secondary condition. So it can actually be extremely difficult to make any diagnosis at all, because you're having to work out which is the primary one. You've also got the fact that there are certain crossovers. So within, and this is what really picked me up on where you mentioned narcissism, there are narcissistic qualities within psychopathy, such as a grandiose sense of self-worth. And we talk about psychopathy and narcissism as being immature personality disorders. And I'll try and explain what we mean by that. So not that I like using this because it's an unscientific structure, but Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And the reason I say that is it's one of those common usage where we kind of just accept, but there was no ever scientific investigation into whether it holds up. But it's kind of like a good way of explaining it. So we have our base needs like food and water. I think above that, the security, love and family, friendship, up to self-actualization. And both narcissists and psychopaths really are just concerned with the two bottom levels. And this is what we mean by immaturity. Right? A narcissist isn't concerned with self realization and actualization. In fact, their whole condition is fighting against that. So what you have is, if you had a brush in with somebody who was grandiose, you know, and had that sort of high sense of self-worth, you don't know the condition. Are they a psychopath? Are they a narcissist. There's kind of a meshing. It's kind of interesting. I read a study in, I think it was 2013, Hancock and Woodworth, who did a really interesting one, which was looking at the speech patterns of psychopaths and non-psychopaths. And basically, they had a base of those who had committed homicides. So you had the non-psychopaths and the psychopaths. And what they found out that when they interviewed both groups to sort of relive and retell the story of why they'd killed and, you know, what were the events behind it, with the non-psychopaths, they would talk about sort of like love, being betrayed, you know, all of these human emotional things, where the psychopaths would talk about what they ate that day, what they had to drink, and these kind of lower level type of things. So you start to see what, like, the psychopaths are actually concerned with. They're concerned with very low level things, you know, about having enough to eat, having enough to drink, you know, having shelter, blah, blah, blah. They don't have that sort of desire or ability to self-actualize. So you have things there where there's that commonality between narcissism and psychopathy.
And I think that's probably, we'll get into the checklist shortly, I think, because I think that will be useful for people. But this commonly quoted meme about why one in four CEOs are psychopaths, for example. I have no idea if that has any scientific merit or not, but I think everyone likes to think their boss is a psychopath.
Absolutely,
because it justifies why they're always angry at me. But
it's a powerful label, because if, for example, at some point the board want to get rid of that individual and they've already labeled them as a psychopath, it makes it much easier. Well, the guy was clearly a psychopath. You know, so it can be self-serving to the groups who label. And like you say, I have no idea. You know, most of the research has been done on prison populations where when people come in, they get screened. You know, I don't believe there's such a process for when somebody starts work or at various phases where, you know, there is a psychiatric or psychological evaluation. Or if it is, I'm sure it's very, very couched. Because of privacy concerns and the like. So, yeah, I think it's like, you know, one in four, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
You know, maybe every fourth boss that I've had, you know, was a bit of an ogre and a bit of a nightmare. And like, okay, yeah, that seems anecdotally good.
It's a bit of a strange one. I can't imagine that there's a whole lot of CEOs that are lining up to possibly be diagnosed and have their entire life ruined. You know, like it's especially if they suspect it might be true.
Right. And there are certain things as well, and I think this is what often gets overlooked, and this is something I have to explain to companies that bring me in. You know, that CEO isn't able to have a genuine connection with every one of their employees. So the role means that the level of glibness and, you know, superficialness to it. And that's just inherent in the role. It's not saying that's who the person is, but, you know, if they're overseeing, you know, 1,000 employees, they're not going to have that deep relationship with them. So if you interview that employee, they go, yeah, he seemed a bit glib. He didn't really seem to care too much about, you know, my working conditions. Of course he didn't. He's got much bigger fish to fry. So I think one of the things, again, when especially people are looking at higher management, is what is the role and the relationship with other roles beneath them? And, you know, that doesn't mean that that person's way of behaving is actually a character trait. And obviously when we're looking at a diagnosis of psychopathy, we're trying to turn around and say, is that a character trait? Is it problematic and persistent? And I know that might sound like I'm giving a lot of bad bosses a kind of buy on that, but I think we do have to be looking at what does a role demand. Like, if you were ever served in the military, it's a hierarchical organization, you know, and people of certain ranks have a way of interacting with people of a lower rank. And that's just the structure. And I think, you know, to turn around and say that, you know, every sergeant major, because he screams and shouts, et cetera, is a psychopath, you know, and because he doesn't seem to care deeply about me, I think is to misunderstand the role that that person is trying to perform and the relationships that they're having with those around them. So I think structure in a corporate setting, when we're talking about these things, is really, really important.
Yeah, no, I think it's also just important to recognize you can be an asshole without being a psychopath.
Absolutely. And this is again,
objectionable, you know?
Often what, you know, where people want me to come in and diagnose somebody as a psychopath is in an instant of workplace bullying. And you can turn around and go, there's a million reasons why workplace bullying occurs, you know, and yes, maybe one of them is because the individual is a psychopath, but that's only one reason. And to sort of like sort of equate the two is extremely dangerous, because if you have an environment that is conducive to workplace bullying, yet you're turning around and going, well, the reason we have workplace bullying is it's all these psychopaths. You're never going to deal with the actual issue of workplace bullying. You know, and I think for some people it's very convenient just to put a label on somebody and go, well, they stroke that as the problem. It's not what we've got set up here.
Yeah, well, one person never makes a culture. It's, yes. You know, no matter what their position is. I think what you made there, well, the point you made there about different roles, I think is really important as well. I mean, I remember reading something that suggested that trauma surgeons were psychopaths. And I thought, you know, that's interesting, because if I'm a trauma surgeon and I'm going to be operating on X number of patients a year and I know a certain percentage of them aren't going to make it, I don't want to be forming emotional connections with every patient, like probably no patients, right? How long would you last in that career if you deeply cared about every person that died on your table? Like it would be impossible.
And the other thing as well is, you know, there can be contradictory positions. So, you know, I know we're trying to stay away from kind of like the sort of notorious serial killers. But Ted Bundy worked for many years on a suicide prevention hotline and was extremely successful. You know, there's kind of an irony that he might have actually saved more lives than he took. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, if you come out even, you save 30 and you kill 30, but somehow, you know, you're let off and given a bye. You know, if you come out in a positive, like you should get a medal or something. But I'm sure part of what enabled him to be successful in that job was being kind of a little bit dispassionate. And I know that sounds weird. Or maybe he was able to cognitively read the emotion and respond to it rather than getting caught up in the emotion. And again, I'm speculating here. So I think, again, it's, you know, we can turn around and go, like you say, psychopathy evil. But we have to acknowledge that side of a Ted Bundy who scored 39 out of 40 on, you know, Hare's checklist. And another very interesting thing about Bundy is, and this is, I would say, you know, if we're looking at practically with dealing with psychopaths, is we are all susceptible to their charm. And this is something I remember the first time when I worked with a prison population, and the professor who was with me said, these guys are trying to con you. And as clever as you think you are, they're better at it. And you had... After the sentence of the death penalty was given to Ted Bundy, the judge, summing up in his remarks, said, this is a terrible loss of life, not meaning Bundy's victims, but Bundy himself. He was saying, like, the fact that you have to be executed, he sort of says, is the greatest sadness of my career. You know, he said, because Bundy represented himself, he said, you'd have made a fantastic lawyer. I would have loved to have you practicing law in my court. But, and he uses something like the term partner, but partner, you took a wrong turn. But he referred to in his career that having to sentence Ted Bundy to death was the greatest loss of life. And I think if you think about somebody being tried for 30, he confessed to 30 murders, and you're going, executing you is the greatest loss of life. I mean, that's somebody who's done a job on you.
Wow. Yeah, it's that's pretty fascinating. I think it was The Gift of Fear, De Becker. The first time I came across this idea that charm is a skill. It's not an attribute. You're not charming because you're a nice person. You have the ability to charm.
And
it's so true.
It's not a character trait. It's a behavior.
Yeah.
You know, I can charm you to get you to behave or act in a certain way, whilst all the time having extremely nefarious purposes, you know, and motivations behind that.
Well, I think that maybe that's why, just speculating from my end, but maybe that's why it's so intrinsically linked to psychopathy, because I don't have any emotion towards you anyway, so I can be completely clinical in the way I manipulate you, because I don't have to overcome any resistance.
Well, the thing is, and I think this is one of the things that kind of gets forgotten, is people have a bit of disconnect, which is, why is somebody who doesn't get emotional kind of playing with somebody's emotions? You know, I think that's another one if we talk about misconceptions. And the reason being is that one of the characteristics of psychopathy in Hare's checklist is that of boredom, that these individuals get bored very, very quickly. So they create games to kind of entertain themselves. And so whilst they don't understand, let's say, the discomfort they're putting somebody under from an emotional point of view, they do from a cognitive position. There's a great scene in, No Country for Old Men. I don't know if you've seen it, where, I forget the actor, where he goes in and basically he's wanting to get the gas attendant to flip the coin. And basically, the gas attendant doesn't understand what this game is. And really, it's whether he gets killed or not. Mm. And you'd kind of go, well, why is a psychopath engaged in this? Like, they don't really understand, like, the emotional discomfort. And it's that they do understand it. They're bored. And they're going to play a game with it. Because they another condition is they don't have long-term goals. So what they're doing is kind of for that moment, you know, let me entertain myself.
I was just going to say, to me, like a psychopath playing with your emotions is kind of like us with a laser pointer and a kitten, right? It's like, yes. I don't understand why you're fascinated with it, but it's entertaining to watch.
Yes, yeah. and it's that kind of boredom thing, you know. And again, if you come back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where they're working of that very low level, you know, they just need to be entertained for half an hour. What's going to entertain me for half an hour? Well, committing this criminal act or possibly this act of violence will. I mean, the other thing, when we look at the criminality of psychopaths, they really are versatile criminals. You know, whereas most people, and this is when we're looking at the psychopath in a criminal context, not saying that all psychopaths are criminals, they have that versatility. So it's not like, you know, a burglar who sticks largely to burglary or a street robber who sticks largely to mugging. Whatever comes along, an opportunity to do that, I got a spare half hour, okay, I'm breaking into the house. So again, when we start to look at these individuals, it's really about, you know, what's available to me at the moment. You know, and this is, again, I think, one of the dangers where, you know, you try and look too hard to understand what is the motive behind it. It's killing time. That's a large part of the motive.
Yeah, and there's, again, there's no necessarily emotional precipitation. I mean, it's not like they're angry at the person, that's why they killed them. So from an investigation point of view, it's harder to find them because there's may not be any direct link between individuals. So as we sort of near the end, I would like to provide some actionable sort of content for people. So I think that checklist is a really valuable tool in terms of, let's say that we've got someone in our lives that we're concerned about, maybe a psychopath, maybe it's a new partner, maybe it's someone who's hanging around our kids, whatever it is that we're concerned about. What are the things that people should be looking for I won't say to diagnose, but to, I guess, categorize in a way whether someone might be a psychopath.
So I think the first warning sign is if you feel you've got to do that. That would probably be my biggest one. If you feel that you've got you need to investigate an individual in some way to ascertain whether they have a disorder, it shouldn't really matter if they have a disorder or not. If you're at that point of investigating, something's probably wrong. And I think this is sometimes where people go wrong with these kind of personal diagnosis, where they go, oh, I went through the psychopathy checklist. It came out fine. You know, and the fact that you had to do this says there's probably something wrong with your relationship with that person.
Yeah, so, your Google history might give you more indication than anything else.
it's one of the things I always say about carrying pepper spray. If you find your hand reaching in to hold that pepper spray, that's probably the most useful thing that pepper spray has done to you, because it's told you that you shouldn't be in denial or discount the situation. The threat is real. So I'd say the first thing, if you find yourself reaching for the psychopathy checklist, so the PCLR-R, for those of you who want to have a look for it on the web, there's PDFs and all that, that's probably your first issue. The next one is to kind of probably understand how it's organized. So like I said, there's two factors. I would miss that over. Don't get caught up on that, because you'll start thinking they're this type or they're that type. What you have under each factor is two facets. So under factor one, which is interpersonal, so affective, look on affective being kind of as emotional, you have facet one, which is interpersonal. Is the person glib and superficial? Is it superficial charm? Is there a lack of substance behind who they are? And again, come back to that idea of Maslow's hierarchy. These aren't people who can, it's an immature disorder, who can sort of move up to the next level beyond kind of food, shelter, and survival. Do they have a grandiose sense of self-worth? Pathological lying. Are they conning and manipulative? You know, and if you wanted to score them, zero, no, they're never conning and manipulative. One, sometimes they are. Two, they kind of always are. And this is actually just to point out an issue that although we kind of generally accept Hare's checklist, it's not without question and kind of like analysis in terms of its validity. And one of the questions always gets asked of it is, well, you know, for me, I might have a different measure of glibness than you might have. So, you know, it's subjective when we're measuring it, because it's down to the person of the who's interviewing. So I've seen people when I've sort of mentioned these things gone, that's him. You know, it's like, he's glib, he's superficial, he's always conning me. But, you know, and it's like, hang on a minute, you kind of want to believe this.
Yeah.
You know,
you're excited about this, yeah.
That's it, you've nailed it. And any diagnosis has to be made objectively. Like, we need to look at, like, okay, so you say the guy is a pathological liar. Let's actually look at the number of untruths he's spoken within a period of time. Okay, that will give us an idea if it's pathological. You know, if it's, you know, when you ask him, you know, what you look like in a certain dress, and he always goes, you look great, honey. You know, and then you turn around and go, I don't think he meant it. I don't think he can categorize that as pathological lying. But if you're wanting to see this person as a psychopath, you'll put that down and include it. So there needs to be some objectivity when you go through this list. The next one is the affective. And the biggest one is the lack of remorse and guilt. And there's an argument that one of the problems with Hare's checklist is everything is weighted evenly, where really should it be that lack of remorse and guilt is actually a more significant factor than superficial charm. You know, and again, I would turn around and go, context. You know, superficial charm, what's the context within you witnessed that superficial charm? I think that's important. Lack of empathy, again, maybe that's more important. Failure to accept responsibility. However, what you've got to look at is how these two facets interrelate, because otherwise you could be theoretically misdiagnosing somebody with another disorder. So if you focus on the grandiose sense of self-worth, maybe you're actually looking at dealing with a narcissist. And the easiest way to sort of identify if you're dealing with a narcissist is ask them if there's anything in their life that they could change which would make them better. And if they turn around and say, no, this is as good as it gets, there's no room for improvement, then you're probably dealing with a narcissist. You know, so there are almost like questions within questions. And this is where really for somebody to use this properly, there needs to be a level of training and understanding behind it. The two other facets, 3 and 4, which come under factor 2, which is lifestyle and antisocial, are kind of more measurable. And these kind of correspond more to the antisocial personality disorder. They're much more measurable because it's hard to measure pathological lying, you know, because you could only be aware of 20% of the lies, you know. So these are the things where, again, there needs to be a greater level of investigation. But a clear one is like parasitic lifestyle. You know, is this person living off you? Do they lack long-term goals? Are they impulsive? Are they prone to boredness? Do they have a history of juvenile delinquency? These are the more measurable things. But to be honest, if you're experiencing these things with another person, you know, like they, you know, are impulsive, and they're impulsive in a way that is a detriment to their and your safety, regardless of whether they're a psychopath, that's a warning flag. And I think this is sometimes where, I don't like to use the term common sense, but like if you're asking these questions, you know, you're actually applying a certain level of common sense. You know, this is a bad person. Yeah. You know, this person doesn't really care for me. And, you know, does it matter what the disorder is? You know, and this is sometimes where I think, and this is again the problem with a lot in the self-defense world, that does it really do me any good knowing that the person is a psychopath? Probably not. It's not really important. What's important is, does this person have a concern for my safety or not, regardless, you know, of their diagnosis? And this is the thing where sort of the point of psychopathy as a condition is to identify and treat it. That's the purpose. So if you're not involved in treating it, I have some questions of why it should be such a central feature of your approach to self-defense, if that makes sense. And that's not to downplay that it can be important to understand what's making somebody tick, but it might not be the most important thing.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
I think that's a really strong take-home point. And while you were talking about that, I just had flash forward to the future of my daughter's bringing home boyfriends. And, you know, like at the end of the day, do you feel safe? I don't care what he scores. Check, yeah. Right? If he scores 6 out of 40, but you don't feel safe, then
it doesn't matter.
I don't care, right?
and this is where, again, I think sometimes these disorders are used in a lazy fashion, you know, where it's like, he's a psychopath. And it's like, it doesn't matter. That's not what is being affected in the relationship. It's that person's inability to care for your safety. Done. You know, I don't need to go any further in my investigation. Because, like you say, if he comes up with 6, but he's still engaged in this, you know, detrimental behavior, that's an issue. You know, the only thing you might sort of get from that is, can he be trained out of or conditioned or taught that that isn't an issue? Or am I dealing with somebody, and this is a problem with a lot of the disorders, where these behaviors are fairly rigid. They sort of tend to, with the disorders, develop around the early to mid teenage years and become very fixed. Mm-hmm. So I really think that's kind of where you're coming from. Is it interesting stuff to know? Yeah, if you're working in certain settings, is it important to know, such as forensic settings, or whether, you know, releasing somebody back out into the community is going to cause a risk? Okay, that's really important. And an interesting note about psychopaths, those that undergo treatment actually go on to reoffend more. So that they almost learn how to manipulate the parole board, get released early, and go out. So, you know, just on a note of treatment, it's like we don't have a successful treatment for psychopathy. We have one that makes it worse, you know, because we're educating them how to interact and behave. So that's just an interesting note kind of on that.
Yeah, very interesting, mate. I appreciate your insight and your time. For those that want to know more about you, where can they go to find out?
Probably the best place to go is bostonkravmagar.com, right, or go to kravmagarblog.com. And that way you'll probably get a better idea of my thoughts on other subjects as well, because I write weekly on areas of personal safety, including this stuff.
Yeah, make sure you check out that blog. There's hundreds of posts. It's probably one of the most consistent blogs on the internet, especially in this niche anyway. Make sure you check that out. All right, Gershon's going to stick around and do the bonus questions for Patreon contributors. But for those of you that are leaving us now, thank you, Gershon, Ben, Karen, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you very much. Great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you once again to Mr. Gershon, Ben, Karen, for a topic that, as we discussed, I think is so important that we have an understanding of, and we don't just go with the pop psychology or whatever we've read in an article. It's something we really need to understand. If we're going to talk about people that suffer from psychopathy or sociopathy, we have a duty to understand that and to make sure we're passing on correct information to our students. If you'd like to know more, please check out Gershon's website and blogs. He's full of information, and there's a ton more reading material out there if you'd like to know more. Until next time, I'll talk to you again soon.